Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer Evan Friss. He's professor of history at James Madison University. And we're talking about his new book, The Bookshop, A History of the American Bookstore. Evan, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this great book.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks, Mark.
This is one of those books, and I don't get them that often, where, you know, it's just, it was a totally enjoyable read. I learned a lot, and I just went straight through it. It's just like...
Well, I appreciate that.
Plus the fact, it's about something I really love, bookshops. How did it's amazing the territory that this book covers, from Benjamin Franklin's workshop to Amazon, and then all the little outside booksellers, everything. But the whole book is bracketed by stories of two independent bookstores, Three Lives and Company and Parnassus. Talk to me about why that was important to you to bracket this whole history with two independent bookstores.
Well, I start the beginning of the book at Three Lives because it's kind of a beginning, end, and end. It's where the current day bookstore scene can possibly be seen in the most thriving kind of bookstore imaginable. But it's also the beginning for me personally, because that's where the whole idea of this book originated. My wife just lucked into a job at Three Lives and Company. I was in graduate school in New York City. And it was really through her and that shop in particular that I began to appreciate the depth and the many layers of book selling. And so it sparked my curiosity about the history of the subject and really planted the idea for this book. So I wanted to really give the reader a colorful and vivid kind of depiction of this place that was so inspiring to me to write the book in the first place.
Why are bookstores still important? By the way, I'm using the word bookstores instead of bookshop, which I think, if I remember right, in your book you say bookshop is really the British term.
Well, they're both fine and mostly interchangeable. There are some shops, and I didn't mean to suggest.
Is there a regional preference in the United States?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think they're largely interchangeable, but there are some bookshops that do prefer the label, because it suggests something perhaps slightly cozier or homier and maybe less commercial or capitalist, at least as a kind of, symbol or sign.
I mean, you write that if bookstores were animals, they'd be on the list of endangered species. So it seems to me that one of your missions in this book is to explore why bookstores are so important.
That's really the starting point. So we historians are often trained to be objective and distant from our subject matter, and that's not what I did at all here. So I started with an institution that I fell in love with, and throughout the course of my lifetime saw this great decline in the number of bookstores, thousands and thousands of bookstores that existed when I was a little kid no longer exist. So part of my mission was to uncover the history in a typical historical way. But I also wanted to speak to the present and give people a sense of how important these institutions are and how important bookstores have been over the course of history, highlighting the many different kinds of roles that they've played. And hopefully readers will come to appreciate and patronize their bookstores as a result.
You call them de facto public spaces, and that's especially true now for independent bookstores.
Yeah, so they're really spaces often of community and communion, and in our increasingly insular lives that many of us live, there are fewer and fewer of these spaces to congregate. Sociologists have used the term third spaces to refer to not our home and not our workplace, but what other kinds of places do we engage in regularly, feel comfortable in, provide us with some other kind of outlet. And the number of people participating in recreation activities has dropped. The number of people attending religious services has dropped. And, you know, we could go on and on and on. So we really need these kind of spaces like coffee shops and bookstores where we can go out into the public, perhaps rub shoulders with people. In the case of a bookstore, be exposed to new ideas and different kinds of books. But also being around people, I think, is important, and even more so today than ever.
Also, I just want to know if you think this is true. I think literacy rates have dropped dramatically. If I was to ask friends of mine how many books they've read like this past year, the answer is really shocking.
Yeah, so there's been a fairly steady decline in the number of readers, people who read for pleasure, you know, outside of work or school. And even in the context of school, I know this as a parent of two school-aged children, the demands that they have for reading are much less than they used to be. And as myself, a college professor, I assign considerably less reading than I did when I first started in the job. So that is certainly a headwind. I will say the pandemic in some ways exacerbated these problems in terms of K-12 education, for sure. But in other ways, a lot of adults actually refound their love of reading, and they found themselves with maybe a bit more time or stuck inside their house looking for other kind of leisure pursuits. And so there was actually an uptick in reading and in book sales that surprised many people during the pandemic. So hopefully there's some stickiness to that.
Hmm. In between your major chapters, and this is mostly a chronological history, there are these great little short essays on sort of characters or people who are associated with bookstores. Just talk about one or two of them.
Yeah, so figuring out a framework for the book was very difficult because I'm trying to tell the history of the American bookstore, which is, of course, large and sweeping, but also to provide color and detail and make it an interesting read. So I try and highlight these particular shops at pivotal moments in bookselling history. But then I had all these other kind of interesting stories, almost one-offs, and I was trying to figure out how to weave them in, and came up with this idea of using these kind of interludes or interstitials between the chapters that are, somebody described them as a kind of palate cleanser.
Yeah,
I like.
Yeah.
And they're supposed to be, you know, light and fun. So one is about the UPS person, which is a pivotal character in any bookstore that customers might not think much about. There's another one on the smell of a bookstore.
Oh, God, wait. Let's stop there because I love that smell. Now, I want to ask you how you pronounce it. Is it bibliosmia?
Yes, I believe that's how you pronounce it, although there's some discrepancy over whether or not it's an actual word or not. But my proofreader and copy editor said it was fine, but there's some debate about its legitimacy.
It's the smell of a lot of books.
Indeed, and that's something we associate with walking into a bookstore or a library, and as part of the sensorial experience that is essential and fundamental to why real brick-and-mortar physical bookstores still matter. It's a very different kind of experience. It's not just about a transaction, but it's about this atmosphere, seeing, touching, picking up, and, of course, smelling the objects themselves.
I also think the smell of a used bookstore is better than the smell of a contemporary bookstore.
Yes, and I do write briefly about some people who have very particular taste of smells of books, and there's some people who prefer the smell of a Penguin paperback.
Oh, yeah.
It has this very distinctive smell and aroma. And used books, of course, and different vintages have their own smells, like, you know, wine bottles, I suppose.
And somebody actually tried to bottle that smell.
Yeah, so Powell's, the famed indie bookstore based out of Portland these days, at least its main store, in, I think it was 2020, started bottling a fragrance that was called, you know, Bookstore by Powell, something like that. And essentially it was supposed to capture the smell of Powell's. And you could smell like Powell's, and or you could just open it up and it will transport you to Powell's even if you can't head to the shop.
Did it really work?
I don't know how serious it was.
Okay.
I mean, they did sell out. Like, it worked in terms of the people wanted it, but I don't know how much it was a novelty versus, I think it varied from user to user. And they had this very cheeky commercial that ran that was dramatic and serious about how you could smell like a bookstore. So I think it was a kind of clever campaign. And there were people who certainly bought it. And for many people, of course, you know, they are looking to have that connection to an indie bookstore. Many people don't live near a Powell's or a Strand Parnassus or Three Lives. Many people don't live near a bookstore at all. So they try and find ways to stay connected.
Let's talk about Ben Franklin. And in general, too, often your stories center around a single person who either makes that bookstore legendary or starts the bookstore, but always it's an individual that's behind some of the best stories about bookstores.
Yeah, I think the best bookstores bear the imprint and personality of the people or person behind it. And, you know, Ben Franklin is a fascinating case of obviously a name that everyone is familiar with as a politician and a writer and for his scientific experiments. But he really got his start in printing and then book selling.
But it was all in one place.
Yeah, it was one.
It was one big print shop, you know, where he would write. And then if he had some books around, he would sell those too.
Exactly. And it was, a good example of what the bookstore as a kind of typology was at the time, this very multifunctional place with people coming and going, where they're printing books, selling books, where it's a post office, they're delivering newspapers and all sorts of activity. And in some ways that's because the book market was very small back then. Not every colonist could read, books were expensive. And so books were part of typically these larger operations instead of a kind of standalone bookstore that was selling primarily books that wouldn't really come into popularity until the early 19th century.
Well, you described some of the earliest American bookstores were like pop-ups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. So the first books that were being sold in the colonies were by agents, people who were middlemen from the old world to the new, and sometimes they would be traveling around, and sometimes they would set up, you know, temporary shops to just sell the latest wares from London.
Now, when Ben Franklin was selling these books out of his store or his place of business, I should say, mm-hmm. what titles? Obviously, the Bible would be one of them.
Yes.
But what else would he sell?
Yeah, a lot of religious works. Psalm books and things of that nature. Sermons from popular preachers. He would also sell a lot of textbook kind of material, books for school, but also books for people to learn. And he would sell classics, you know, great kind of, you know, Swift and later on Enlightenment texts like Voltaire and things like that.
Now, he also wrote, and he wrote Poor Richard's Almanac. And that has to have been a bestseller. Well, what the equivalent of a bestseller back then.
Absolutely. That was a great moneymaker for him because he wrote it, he printed it, and then he sold it at his bookstore. So he sort of was able to cut out all the various middlemen. And the genius of it was that it's an annual publication that needed to be re-updated every year. So, you know, his regular customers would buy it year after year.
So he had a ready-made market.
Exactly. And he was somewhat of a wholesaler, too. So he would print them and then sell them to the relatively few other bookstores in the colonies.
And he also printed and sold pamphlets. Could you give me an idea about what a pamphlet would be versus a book?
Yeah, so just kind of essays. You know, many of the things that we would even call books back then probably wouldn't look like a book to us. So if it was short, which was often the case because it was very expensive to print and it took a lot of time and money to ship around the colonies. So a lot of the texts people were reading were almost more like essays that would be bound together and stitched in what we would call probably a pamphlet by looking at it. And some of these things he wrote himself. His wife, Deborah, often did the stitching and binding of these pamphlets. Wow. And when he tried to print larger books, and there's a brief story in the book about this book called Pamela, which was the first novel printed in the colonies, and it was reprinted from Britain, a guy named Samuel Richardson, and it was a huge flop in many ways because Americans weren't really interested in novels and these longer texts, and it was also very expensive to produce because it was a full-length book, unlike some of these smaller texts.
He also printed Thomas Paine's Common Sense, which was an essential text for the Revolution.
Yeah, that was arguably the first, you know, real bestseller in terms of a kind of book that you could go from city to city and expect people to have known about, if not have read themselves or heard. People would read it aloud in coffee shops and political halls. So that book, you know, flooded the colonies and, of course, was instrumental in helping to convince colonists that the ongoing war was not just a war of rebellion or a war about grievances, but was actually a war that should be fought for independence.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer Evan Friss. He's professor of history at James Madison University, and we're talking about his latest book, The Bookshop, A History of the American Bookstore. You even have a chapter at the end about all other books that are about bookshops,
mm-hmm.
that mention bookshop, and you address the, I'm sure everybody is thinking this, the movies that have bookshops in them.
Yeah, so.
What's your favorite one? Personal favorite.
My favorite book about bookstores is definitely 84 Charing Cross Road, which is a great little book that is a series of letters from the author Helene Hampf to her favorite bookshop in London, and she's corresponding back and forth, and it's just remarkably charming and kind of gets at how a customer can fall in love with a bookstore. And in this case, it's a bookstore that she's never even been to, but the booksellers and her have this witty back and forth correspondence. And in a way she feels this deep connection to this bookshop, even though it's thousands of miles away. And it's just a great read. And I recommend it for all bookstore lovers. In terms of film, the movie that everyone likes to talk about is You've Got Mail.
Yeah.
I have seen it 100 times. And it does show up in the book in a couple of
places. It does.
And does honestly, of people, at least of certain generations, shape their idea about bookstores and the bookstore wars between the chains and the independents, because it was so popularly depicted in this film that seemed to run on TV endlessly after it came out. And the interesting thing in talking about, occasionally it will come up, and I just assume everybody has seen this movie, which is largely true, but people who are young, there are a lot of, you know, 20-year-olds that I've talked to who have no idea what the movie is about.
Oh, I know. The great thing about the evolution of the bookstore is the bookstores keep getting bigger and more involved in what they do, and then they turn into chains, and then the chains themselves complain about Amazon. And I love this. The first really big department store bookstore was in Marshall Field & Company. Talk about that bookstore.
Yeah, so I didn't live through the kind of glamour days of department stores, and I was fascinated to study the book department at Marshall Field, and many leading department stores by the 1920s, 30s, and 40s had fairly elaborate and large book sections in them. And what surprised me was how comprehensive they were, that they were able to achieve such scale and be these kind of corporate behemoths. but that they also had the reputation of being, you know, literary centers and tastemakers with hand selling and lots of the kind of traits we might associate with a small indie bookstore today. So they were known for their knowledgeable staff and recommendations.
Yep.
And weren't seen as corporate sellouts, but were these both behemoths and giant companies, but also had the feel and the kind of best of small bookstores. And they managed to accomplish this, you know, for decades on end. Marshall Field's was recognized as one of the greatest bookstores in the United States.
It was Marcella Hahner, I think that's
mm-hmm.
how you pronounce it.
Yes.
She was the captain of that ship. And man, she was amazing. She was the first in-store talks by authors. She organized that.
Yeah, so she helped launch many a career. She helped push certain titles. And she changed the industry single-handedly by having these book festivals essentially in her shop, which brought all these authors and publishers together for really the first time. And the idea that we now take for granted of introducing authors directly to their readers was pretty foreign for most of American history. And there were some publishers who were worried that the authors would actually turn off their customers by their personalities, or that there
That's
was some benefit.
That's still true.
Yes, that is true. But that there was some benefit of being a kind of distant, almost godlike, you know, writer who you didn't see in the person with their flaws. But she helped break that down, that notion. And she was also this. I profile her and a woman named Frances Stelloff.
Oh God, Frances Stelloff. I fell in love with that chapter. The Gotham Bookmart just really sounds like the epitome of the independent bookstore. That was the acme. That was like the best spot for an American independent bookstore.
Yeah, and she. One of the fascinating things is that for, you know, the first half of the 20th century, you could argue that the two most influential booksellers were Marcella Burns Hahner and Frances Stelloff at
yeah.
these two institutions. And they were both women in a very male-dominated world of publishing, that all the big publishing houses, most of the editors were male, certainly the owners and executives were male. And this was a book world that had been largely off limits to women in a variety of ways. And yet these two women not just carved out their own careers, but were legends in their own time and tastemakers and influenced the world of not just bookselling, but publishing.
Well, Frances Stelloff was really a literary agent in the end. I mean, mm-hmm. writers worked at the store.
Yeah, so she had, you know, a Hall of Fame list of authors who, before they were so famous or part of the kind of canon that we would recognize today, were unknown or vulnerable or were artists who were seen as just sort of out of the mainstream. And she catered to the avant-garde, you know, artistic modernist writers, many of whom their books were banned or
oh, yeah.
largely unknown.
Oh, that whole story, man. That's worth the price of admission alone reading that.
Yeah, so she was, you know, she created a home for a large group of writers who might have been deemed as misfits and was ahead of her time in recognizing talent, helping artists, writers get published. And it's amazing that, you know, the list of, you know, Nin and Miller and Joyce and all these now very common names of people who depended on her to have their work read by an American audience.
One time her window was designed by André Breton and Marcel Duchamp.
Yeah, fascinating.
Jeez,
and how this
that's just
know,
amazing.
These two artists who in the 1940s decide they're going to do an installation at the Gotham Bookmart front window, and Frances Stelloff is delighted to have them, even if she doesn't quite get what they're doing. And they make this interesting installation. The main attraction is a kind of a mannequin that has a spigot jutting out of her right knee, like the kind that would be coming out of a house on the outside. And the censors, part of this group called the New York Suppression for the Society of Vice, something like that, this censorship group came around and told her that the installation was problematic, in large part because not of the clantily scad faucet girl, but because there was a poster in the background that featured a bare breast on it. And so Frances Steloff got a bib, and somebody embroidered the word censored on the bib and covered the breast with it to be cheeky. And then her next catalog included a list of books that were subversive or banned, essentially. So she was ahead of her time in terms of, you know, promoting the fact that she was selling works that were unloved in other circles.
We're almost completely out of time. And I just want to mention she threw a book party for Edith Sitwell and Sir Osmond Sitwell. And there's a photograph of the people who attended that party in your book. And that's amazing. Is Ann Patchett sort of the equivalent, contemporary equivalent of Frances Steloff now?
I don't know that there is an equivalent.
Yeah, you're right. Okay.
You know,
she's a figure. She's a figure behind a bookstore.
Absolutely. Ann Patchett is the kind of best-known face of bookselling today, but she came to it already having been famous and a celebrity as a writer, and she's a great champion of book selling and deserves a lot of credit for that. But Steloff was working in a very different environment, and
we're going to have to end it there, Evan.
Yeah.
We're completely out of time. People need to buy the book to find out the rest of the story.
That's right.
My guest tonight has been writer Evan Friss. He's professor of history at James Madison University, and we're talking about his latest book. It's thoroughly enjoyable. The Bookshop: A History of the American Bookstore. Evan, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.